thank you very much, Steve. And again, I'm thanking Reem in absentia for her help with setting everything up, and grateful to Zeifman's for this wonderful lunch. These are my best Wednesdays out of the year, Ellie, when I get the lunch here. Much appreciated. We have the sign-in sheets going around. If you've signed in with your email address in previous weeks, there's no reason to have to add your email address once again. It's there only so that I can follow up afterwards, send you the link for the audio recording online, and follow up on questions that come up during the session that I need to research. I'll also send out, God willing, I'll send out later a link as part of that email for an evaluation for the series. Just this is always helpful for me. It's an opportunity for people to respond on issues of format as well as to suggest topics for future sessions. So that would be your opportunity to do that. The question this afternoon is, as Steve said, the third in a series that really all has to do with debt in one form or another. Our first in the series dealt with bankruptcy. Our second dealt with bouncing checks and the nature of checks in Jewish law in general. And our third topic, the topic for today, is the issue of enslaving a debtor. And really, it comes down to three questions. Question number one. Is a Jew allowed to enter into what Jewish law considers a slave arrangement? And we'll see what that means. What is a slave arrangement? But that's question number one. Question number two. If somebody promises when he borrows money, he writes in his document that he's going to do X if he defaults on the debt. And the X that he agrees to is actually that he is going to seek work in order to pay off his debt. Is that enforceable? In other words, he stipulated in the document, in the event that at the time this loan is due, I default on the debt, then I will go out and get a job. Is that binding? And then the third question, specific to marriage, is there a requirement for a husband to find gainful employment in order to support his wife in the manner to which she is accustomed? So the all three of those questions are questions that are going to come up today. I'm approaching this one differently from the way that I approached the other two topics in this series. The other two topics, we sort of looked at different aspects differently and saw sources that related to each of them differently. But here, all three questions are unified by a 13th century responsum from Rabbeinu Asher, also known as the Rosh. And we're going to look at first background material that will prepare us, and then we'll actually read this responsum of the Rosh, which addresses all three questions together. So we have to begin by talking about debt slavery, the idea that a person who owes money could be enslaved to the person who lent him the money. It is a very old idea, going back to the Code of Hammurabi and earlier. The Code of Hammurabi, roughly call it 18th century before the Common Era, has debt slavery for a limited period of time. Take a look at source number one, please, direct from the Code of Hammurabi, from the King Translation. If anyone failed to make a claim for debt and sell himself, his wife, his son, and daughter for money, or give them away to forced labor, they shall work for 3 years in the house of the man who bought them or the proprietor, and in the fourth year they shall be set free. So 3 years of slavery to the creditor. Now, mind you, the language here does not indicate that the creditor forced him to do it. The language here is he is entitled to sell himself or his wife or his child in order to pay off the debt. Interestingly, they also had periodic debt cancellation and freedom of debt slaves in addition to this, in addition to debt slavery. There's a lot there that ties into some of what we have within Torah. But overall, they did have this debt slavery. One note, actually, that I found of particular interest as I was researching this. The historians explain that the reason why Hammurabi makes sure to have methods of ending debt, debt cancellation, or freedom of debt slaves, is in order to prevent particular citizens from amassing large amounts of property. In other words, the idea is that if a person is able to have a whole bunch of people in his service and owing him money, he becomes a threat to the king. So therefore, the king, every once in a while, just cleans the slate and says, enough of that. All these debts are now erased, and we start fresh. We'll talk more about that, because there are other reasons. Well, we'll see actually right now. That was Hammurabi's code. When you move into Egypt, you find that Egypt went sort of off and on in terms of debt slavery. It existed for periods of time, and then it stopped for periods of time. If you take a look at source number 2 from the historian Diodorus, describing an event in the 8th century before the common era in Egypt, he says, in the case of debtors, the lawgiver, by which he means the pharaoh known as Bakoris, is the way it's written here. I'm blanking now on the other name that he had, something that starts Bach, Bachinathan, or something like that. But he ruled that the repayment of loans could be exacted only from a man's estate. And under no condition did he allow the debtor's person to be subject to seizure, holding that whereas property should belong to those who had amassed it or had received it from some earlier holder by way of a gift, the bodies of citizens should belong to the state, to the end that the state might avail itself of the services which its citizens owed it in times of both war and peace. You don't belong to your creditor, you belong to the state. If the state wants you, the state will take you. But your creditor can't. For it would be absurd, he felt, that a soldier, at the moment perhaps when he was setting forth to fight for his fatherland, should be haled to prison by his creditor for an unpaid loan, and that the greed of private citizens should in this way endanger the safety of all. So, according to what Diodorus states here, there's a second reason to oppose or to end debt slavery, and that is for the sake of the military. You want people to be able to function as citizens of the state. You want people to defend the state. You can't have them working as slaves for a private citizen. And that's a second reason to oppose debt slavery. The third reason we find in Aristotle. Aristotle describes what Greece had, or Athens in particular, before the days of Solon. He says they used to have it, and then Solon abolished it. If you take a look at the third source, the whole country was in the hands of a few persons. He's describing a financial crisis that Greece, or Athens, encountered at the start of the 7th century before the Common Era. He says the whole country was in the hands of a few persons, and if the tenants failed to pay their rent, they were liable to be haled into slavery, and their children with them. All loans secured upon the debtor's person, a custom which prevailed until the time of Solon, who was the first to appear as the champion of the people. The way that it is presented by historians is that Solon abolishes it because of a financial crisis. So your issue here is, again, let's get rid of debt slavery because there's a need of the state, in this case the economy. Each of these three empires, I suppose, or each of these three nations put an end to debt slavery for a particular practical reason, right? The first one, Hammurabi doesn't put an end to it, but Hammurabi limits it because of the need to make sure that competition to the king doesn't arise. The Egyptians get rid of it because they need a military. Solon gets rid of it because it's precipitating financial crisis when too many people are in debt. The Jews have no concept, historically, of debt slavery. Even though slavery undoubtedly exists biblically, there is the idea of a person being made to work and being unable to walk away. Sorry, Evan Ivri, exactly. Nonetheless, it's not for payment of a debt. If you take a look at source number 4, the Torah describes a case in which somebody steals and cannot pay his debts, and it writes, Shalem yeshalem, im ein lo v'nim kar b'gnevaso. He shall pay for his theft. If he has none, he shall be sold for his theft. And on this, the sages comment in source number 5 in the Talmud, a couple of thousand years ago, v'nim kar b'gnevaso, the Torah says, he shall be sold for his theft, v'lo b'kfeilo, but not to pay his doubling, meaning that the rule is that a thief has to pay double what he stole. However, if a person can afford to pay for what he stole, he just can't pay for the second time, he can't pay the double, that he does not get sold for. He doesn't have to be sold to pay his fine. Bignevaso, for his theft, velo bizmamo, not for his plot, meaning, as I added in brackets, aid is zomain. That's a whole other area of law that we're not going to get into because it'll be more complicated than it's worth for us right now. But it's essentially a person who tried to bring, who tried to testify falsely that someone else had stolen. And now he has to pay as though he was the thief. And we don't make him sell himself for that. And Bigneva so, further, for his theft, Kevan Shenimkar Pam Achas Shuviatarashe Limochro. Only once. This can only happen once. If once he has been sold for this purpose to pay off his debt, from his theft specifically, he can't be sold again. The general rule is, as we see the limitation here in source number 5, and we'll see more about that later on, there is no concept within Torah of selling somebody off in order to pay his debts. Only in the case where he has committed a crime and stolen, that's a different story. So the question is, why? Is it one of the three reasons we've already given? Practical concerns, or is there something else going on, Steve?
But could a person sell himself, not sell, could a person essentially sell himself into slavery voluntarily?
Right.
And what that would have been for financial reasons, presumably had debts. So it's not that the creditor can force him to become a slave.
Right.
To pay back the debt. So it's different than these other cases. But the person himself could feel that his financial situation was so dire that he could sell himself and become an evadigri.
Right.
In addition to the theft situation.
Right. So the answer is yes. The case in which one is allowed to do that is specifically where he doesn't have the means of survival. Meaning, if he is so destitute that it's either this or starvation, then he's allowed to do it. But other than that, he's actually not allowed to.
Which is similar to the Code of Hammurabi.
Right, the part that I brought you from the Code of Hammurabi did not discuss whether he has the option to. It only said that it did say he can. I should say it does empower him to do it, but Hammurabi doesn't seem to indicate that it has to be where he's destitute. What we're saying in Jewish law is he actually has to be broke in order to be able to do this. So, what would be the reason? Is it practical, or can you think of a religious reason why one wouldn't be allowed to do this? Yes, Zev. Very good. We have a verse which says, Hashem declares, God says, Li b'nei Yisrael avadim avadayhem. They are my slaves, God declares. And based on that, the sages in the Talmud comment that we are slaves of God, we are not slaves of other human beings. If you take a look, well, we'll get to it. It's actually a passage in the Talmud that I didn't bring here because it's going to be part of source number 8. So we'll get to it when we arrive there. But indeed, it is a religious issue. Within Judaism, it is a religious issue of human beings are not meant to be slaves to other human beings. Where you committed a crime, that's a different story. Because a crime has been committed against somebody else and that person has to be made whole. But barring that, we don't believe in this sort of enslavement. So, what we still need to describe and discuss is what is slavery, because we have to define that properly. But that's where we're going to go now. A Jew indeed is not supposed to sell himself into slavery willingly to pay his debt. If you take a look at source number 6. You find a core text regarding at-will employment. Right? Canada is not at-will. But well, it's at-will in one way and not in the other. In other words, in the United States, you have what's called at-will employment, meaning that the employee is allowed to leave middle of the job. There's some due notice required, but that's it. And the employer is allowed to cut loose the employee. Again, due notice, and maybe there's severance or whatever there is, but he's allowed to fire him. He does not have to prove cause and so on. That's full at-will employment. As I understand it, in Canada, it's one-sided, meaning that the employee is allowed to leave at will. However, the employer is not allowed to terminate the employee at will. The employer is bound. The employee is not bound. Within Jewish law, it is indeed at will for the employee. What the employer's rules are more challenging, and that's something that really requires its own class. But the employee at will situation is certainly there. In source number 6, you see, Po'el yachol lachzor bo afilu b'chatzi hayom. A worker, and a po'el means a worker who's been hired by the period of time as opposed to by the job. So someone who was hired, I'm going to pay you X and you're going to work for me today. If he decides in the middle of the day, you know, this isn't fun anymore, he's entitled to go home. He's entitled to leave in the middle of the day. Of course, he can't claim payment for the entire day, but he's allowed to walk away. Yes?
Ontario actually is incorrect.
Yeah?
Ontario's employer could say goodbye, to pay him the severance, no requirement, no excuse, no reason.
Really?
No.
How do they deal with the Federal Labor Act?
Because they're not federal, they're provincial. Once you're a federal
right, but
company, under the Federal Act, the labor code is only provincial.
Interesting. So Ontario can have its own rules regarding that.
It's very clear. Basically, yeah. You need to give whatever notice is.
Yeah.
And you can remove them as long as you give them severance.
Interesting. Okay. I stand corrected. Thank you. Yehuda.
This source from Open Theater, if the worker does leave in the middle of the day, is he allowed to claim his wages for the amount of work that he did? Or is it a day giving that he...
So, right. So the answer is he can claim for what he did, sort of. And the reason I say sort of is because it does depend on the damage he has caused by walking away. So the boss is going to have to hire somebody else for the rest of the day. And let's pretend the following scenario. Let's say that when he hired him this morning, it was, for his type of work, it was $100 for the day. He worked for half the day. However, things changed during the day. For whatever reason, the cost of labor became more expensive. That's, in fact, why he left, because he got a good offer somewhere else from somebody to work for the second half of the day. So now, his employer is going to have to pay, instead of paying $50 to get somebody for the rest of the day, his employer is going to have to pay $100 to get somebody for the rest of the day. The former employee who walked away may have to eat the costs that he has now inflicted upon the boss, because the boss, you know, should have only been paying $50 for the afternoon, not $100 for the afternoon. And that's actually what we're going to get to right now. If you take a look at source number 7 from the Mishnah, so we're now more than 2,000 years ago, Sacharas hachamar ve'as hakadar. Somebody hires a donkey driver. Somebody hires a caravan. And they give other cases. Kol davar she'aved v'chazru bahen. Anytime the work will be lost, meaning that it's time sensitive. It has to be done right now. V'chazru bahen, and the employee walks away, he recants. Makom she'ein sham adam, if there's nobody else he can hire, socher aleihen omat'an, then he is allowed to hire others at their expense, meaning if he can't find somebody at the rate he was paying the first guy, then he is entitled to hire somebody at a higher rate and take it out of the employee who had walked away, like the case I just gave. Or he can trick them, meaning he can go to this fellow who's leaving and say to him, listen, I'll pay you $100 for the just for the afternoon, and then not do that. Because, fundamentally, this person had agreed to work for him and had tricked him out of the difference in salary. So therefore, he is entitled to do this. I don't advise it as a general practice. That's not practical advice. But that's the idea, at least theoretically. And the point that I wanted to draw from these two sources, from number 6 and 7, is that generally speaking, unless it's going to harm the enterprise for which he is working, he's basically free to walk away as he chooses, when he chooses, for whatever reason he chooses. And the reason for that is source number 8, and here we go back to the point that Zev made. Rabbi Mordechai ben Hillel, also known as the Mordechai, his commentary appears in the back of a standard edition of the Talmud. He writes, Po'el yachol lachzor bo, mitam kili b'nei Yisrael avadim. A worker is allowed to recant because of that verse where God says, the children of Israel are slaves for me, and not for other human beings. Mihu, however, he says, afal pi chein mutar adam lahaskir asmo. He says that doesn't keep you from getting a job. In other words, envision the university graduate who tells his parents, I'm not actually going to go get a job. Why not? Well, because the Torah says that I am only supposed to be a slave to God. I am not going to get a job. I am not going to be a slave. So they can point to this line in the Mordechai who says, getting a job is not the same thing as slavery. He says, that verse doesn't keep somebody from hiring himself out for work in general. Didavka eved ivri, it is specifically this concept of the slave, she'eino yotzei kodem zmano, what makes somebody a slave, he says, is he can't leave early. He doesn't have the ability to walk away. It requires a document of emancipation. That's where we say, over mishum ki da 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 ba dai heim. That's where you would be violating the principle of being a slave to God. The key is you have to be able to walk away. Yehuda.
I'm just wondering how the word fight isn't like contradicting itself in the sense that the same pasuk tells you that you know, you're not, you can get out of a job because you're slave, but don't think that this pasuk means that a job is slavery. I mean,
right, because the key is that the first half he stresses the ability to leave in the middle. In other words, what he's saying is, this verse says you can't take on slavery. What distinguishes the worker from the slave is the fact that he can leave in the middle of the day. If he couldn't leave in the middle of the day, this verse would prohibit it. But because he can, it's okay. That's the way to read his line. He's allowed to leave in the middle of the day because of this verse.
So remuneration is not offensive.
Correct. It has nothing to do with how much you're being paid. It has to do with your liberty to leave the job. The definition of a slave in Jewish law, and for those, we're not going to go into a whole discussion about slavery now, but if you're familiar with the rules that are imposed on a person who holds slaves within the Torah, all the restrictions and the rules about providing the slave with a better bed and making sure that you feed him and not giving him, you know, harsh work and so on, the only advantage given to an employer within this context is that the worker can't walk away, that he holds the person's freedom. Zeph?
Well, Rabbi, what about if a person signs a long-term employment contract?
That is exactly the problem. I mean, not the loan problem, but that's where we are heading into precisely that question. We have to figure out whether this is really the only distinguishing factor in slavery or whether there's another factor we're going to have to talk about, but that's exactly where this goes. When you look in Canada's labor code, and here, you know, I was working under the assumption that federal law was binding, so I don't know if everything that I'm going to say now is going to be so, but I will rely on you to correct me. But I brought you the link for the labor code in source number 9, and what I noted there, and I didn't bring you the actual text because there's no text to bring, what I noted there is that it has all sorts of duties for employers. Employers have this obligation, that obligation, the other obligation, all sorts of duties for employers. There is no duty listed for an employee regarding termination of service, only that before certain kinds of leave are taken, he has to provide 4 weeks' notice, where reasonable. And that's basically it. Or they discuss union negotiations and union actions and what kind of notice is required there. But in terms of the employee walking away in the federal code, there's literally zero discussion. It sounds like if he decides tomorrow he wants to walk away, That's his option. That's why there's no text there, because there's nothing to bring. You can look up the code yourself. And again, not necessarily true in Ontario. Please, you know, see your lawyer before trying this. In terms of, sorry.
See your employee.
Yes. So what is our definition then of slavery, which we say you're not supposed to engage in? Well, number one is agreement not to leave. Right? That's the first principle. However, take a look, please, at source number 10. Rabbi Moshe Isserles, writing in the middle of the 16th century in Poland, in the Ashkenazi portion of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, says the following: Asur lipoel, it is prohibited for a worker, afilu milamed osofer, even if he is a teacher or a scribe. He is prohibited lahaskir atzmo lihios bebeis bal habayis bekeva shlosha shanim. He is not allowed to hire himself out to be established in the house of the employer for 3 years. What has he added here to the terms of slavery, to the definition of slavery? Long-term indenture, but...
It's the house.
Being in the house, good. And, Dori, you were saying... He's given us a time frame.
Right.
Correct. What we now have, even though, as you see in the parentheses in source number 10, he's quoting the same Mordechai that we read before, he's adding two key details. It sounds like surrendering your freedom to walk away is not the only definition, the only characteristic of slavery. It is working in this person's house, which I would expand to mean his estate. I don't think it means physically the walls of the house. But working on this person's property, and where it is more than 3 years. Up to 3 years, you can surrender your freedom. You're entitled to make a commitment to somebody and say, I'm going to work for you this year, and I will not break my contract. But if your contract is more than 3 years, and you're working in the person's facility, the person's estate, then he's not willing to allow you to do it.
Is it that he's working in the estate, or is it the exclusivity?
It's all of the above. And the way that Ramah frames this, it's indeed all of the above.
How does he arrive at 3 years?
Where in the world did you get 3 years from? What's with the 3 years? That's a really good question. I am glad you asked.
Rabbi,
I was glad he asked. Go ahead, Dory.
How does Shemitah work? Let's say he agrees for a 3-year term, which is a maximum, and then on the second year, it's Shemitah year. Does he go free?
Right, so it doesn't, because when we say that, what Dory's referring to is that the biblical text says, it was last week's Torah portion, that when somebody is indeed a slave, they go free after 6 years. But that's not the Shemitah year. It's whenever 6 years would come up, that's when he would go free. So, if you take a look on your sheet...
But he's not released in the...
I'm sorry?
It's enjoyable that he's released.
It's in the... Well, the Jubilee year is when he has to be released. You don't have any options of holding him any further. That's true. And if that were within the 3 years, he'd still go free. Take a look at source number 11, please. Source number 11 is the source that tells us that, in general, employment is considered the equivalent of slavery for these, or considered a sale. He's considered to be selling himself. Actually, no, I'm going to say it outside of the text. The text itself is more complicated than it needs to be. But the issue there that they're dealing with is the law called Onah, which we've discussed in other years. Onah is the prohibition against cheating people on prices by charging more than the market normally charges, or, in the opposite, cheating a seller by buying something for far less than the market normally charges. You're not supposed to deviate more than a certain percentage from the standard in the market. Now, that is stated usually regarding sales. So what the Talmud asks is, will that apply to employee wages also? If the employee charges more than the going rate, or if the boss pays less than the going rate, will we also apply the terms of Ona'a? And the Talmud says, yes. That's source number 11. My point in bringing that is only to show you that an employment, when a person hires himself out, it really is like he's selling himself for that period of time. And that's the analogy between working and being a slave. But in terms of the 3 years and where this 3-year thing comes from, how we know 3 years, take a look at source number 12. Source number 12 is regarding a mitzvah called Ha'anaka. Don't be surprised if you haven't heard about it. It hasn't been practiced in a very long time. But in a world in which slavery actually exists, the rule is that at the end of the period of slavery, he is set free and he is given gifts. There is a requirement for the employer to give him gifts, and that's the mitzvah of Ha'anaka. So the Torah says there, in source number 12, in the verse that describes giving these gifts, Lo yikshev einecha b'shalechacha oso chavshi me'imach. It shouldn't be difficult in your eyes to set him free. Ki mishne sechar sachir avadcha sheish shanim. He has worked for you double that of a paid worker. 6 years. So the biblical text there says, he worked for you for 6 years before going free, like Dory mentioned, double what a paid worker would do, which is then 3 years. Now, the Talmud actually discusses this and whether that's what it means here. Maybe what it means is, because he works for you day and night, whereas normally a paid worker is only by day. But take a look at source number 13, where it's more explicit. Ve'ata diber Hashem le'mor. A prediction from the prophet Yeshaya Isaiah. He says, God has spoken, he tells the Jews, Bishalosh Shanim, in another 3 years, Kishnei Sahir, like the years of a paid worker, and then he makes a prediction about what is going to happen in 3 years. But the point is, he says explicitly, 3 years is the term of a paid worker.
Is it possible that the police got this decree that particular boss?
That what? That, sorry, that Hammer
wrote? That working 3 years that he got it from this particular boss?
What do you mean?
Isaiah 16:14.
Yeah, that who got it from... Oh, no, without a doubt. Absolutely, yes, that is absolutely correct. The idea of the three-year limit is coming from these verses. Yes. What I find very interesting is that Hammurabi, in his code, has a three-year limit on slavery, which will then mirror what we're seeing from these verses. So what that means and what the association was, I can only guess, but I think that it's not random. Yeah.
Why is Isaiah mentioning something twice? Like, why is he saying in 3 years, as is the term of an employer, which is 3 years? Why not just say
in 3 years?
In 3 years.
Right. So,
in a term of an employer, like, I don't know, just say it once. Like, why is he repeating it?
Right. So if you look at the commentaries there on that verse, they tie it into the prophecy that he's actually about to deliver about what's going to happen. For us, it's fortunate simply because it gives us the source to work with. But the upshot of everything we've said in the last half hour is the following. Number one, a Jewish court lacks authority to sell a debtor into slavery to pay his debts. And number two, that under Jewish tradition, as opposed to the other reasons we gave to oppose debt slavery from other sources, the benefit of the economy, the military, whatever, the argument of Jewish tradition is that hiring oneself out in an unbreakable way for 3 years in the employer's facility is prohibited as self-enslavement. It is religiously prohibited as self-enslavement because it would be considered to be an offense against your service of God, which, by the way, isn't just a sort of vague idea. It's a real idea in the sense that, let's say I decided that one day I wanted to go to a class. Right? I don't know, to the lunch and learn at Eichmann's. I'd like to be able to attend. There's going to be a class at 8 o'clock on Monday night at Shari Shemayim. And it's on assisted suicide, and there are flyers on the table. And it's a fascinating topic. I'd like to go. But I can't, because I'm a slave. And therefore, I'm not free. Well, that's no problem. I'll break my term. I can't break my term, because I'm a slave. So it isn't simply a statement of God wants you to serve him and therefore you shouldn't be a servant to human beings. It's a statement that you can't enter into a relationship in which you will be answerable to a person in such a way that you can't be answerable to God. Yeah?
And how is this different from, let's say, soldiers capture in war slaves? Is it the same type of thing? You can only keep them for 3 years and then you have to set them free.
Right. So the wartime situation is a really good question that's a little bit beyond the scope, but what I'll say briefly is, as the Talmud Rambam Shulchan Aruch codified it, you're not actually able to hold captives of war against their will. The rules are such that they won't, you can't, if they choose to be, then they can be with you. Now,
but we can't get into forced slavery in terms of going out and kidnapping or anything.
No, bad thing. Don't do it. Okay. So
they can return to the side that they came from in the war?
So that's the question, is now what happens to them afterwards? Well, their side has been defeated. Their side gone. The you know, those wars we're talking about didn't have, you know, the Marshall Plan. Let's now rebuild them and so forth. So where they would go afterwards is a legitimate question. But in terms of where this now leads us, now we're equipped to start to address the three questions that we asked at the outset in terms of what happens if a borrower stipulated in his contract that he is going to get a job if he defaults. Because the idea here is getting this job, because he defaulted, is the equivalent of enslavement because he doesn't have the option of walking away. He has a debt that has to be paid off. So take a look at source number 14. Now we arrive at Rabbeinu Asher's response on the topic. The Hebrew is on one page. The English fills the other side. That's why we needed, you know, preface in order to get this. But I felt it was worth seeing the way he presented it. It's not as... It, don't be intimidated by the text. It won't take us that long to get through it. But the question that's put to Rabbeinu... Well, first of all, Rabbeinu Asher, just to know sort of his place in the flow of Jewish law and Jewish tradition, he bridges two communities. The Ashkenazi and Sephardi communities of Europe and North Africa start to split, as I understand it, basically 10th century, 11th century, 12th century. When... Before that, you have Gaonim, and the Gaonim are the heads of the central academies, and people who have questions about Jewish practice send them away to the Gaonim, and that's how they get their answers. However, the authority of these yeshivot, and frankly their financial viability it seems as well, starts to break down somewhere in the 10th end of the 10th century, beginning of the 11th century, coupled with various political events that are occurring in the world at that time. You then move into a period in which you have rabbinic authority in local communities, and they're the ones who answer the questions. That begins the period that we call the Rishonim. That is made all the stronger by the Crusades, which disrupt lines of communication, number one, within Europe itself, and number two, between Europe and North Africa. Those Jews who are living in Muslim-controlled countries are not able to communicate with Jews who are living in Christian-controlled countries. It becomes rather problematic. So the result is that you develop this sort of balkanization in which you have communities in one place that are developing their customs and their practices based on their local authorities, and communities elsewhere developing their own. Well, into that picture comes Rabbeinu Asher, who is a leading rabbi in Germany, the end of the 13th century, and then I think it's 1303, he has to flee persecution to Spain, where he becomes a leading authority there. He's gone from Ashkenaz to Sfard. So he is a leading figure in Jewish law in both communities. His writings on Jewish law are accepted in within both communities, and his son is the Tur who writes a landmark code of Jewish law in the 14th century, which becomes the basis for the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law written in the 16th century. He's a very important figure. When he says something, it carries a lot of weight. That's really what I'm trying to get at here. So take a look at the question that's addressed to him. She'ela. Here's the question. For those who are the Hebrew readers, you can see it. Actually, I did it on the English side also. There's going to be a lot more time spent on the question than the answer. This is one of those cases where the questioner pretty much writes out everything that you need to know about what's going on. The she'elas chacham chatzi tshuva. The question of somebody who is wise is half the answer. So, she'ela. Reuven lava mishimon milva b'shtar. Reuven borrowed money, and there's a document documenting the debt. And he encumbers all his property that he owns right now and all property that he will come into possession of. Metatli agav mikarkoi, movable items along with land. And then, having borrowed the money, he gave away all of his assets to a relative of his. And he left himself nothing, not land, not movables, zero. Gave everything away. Yes. Well, we've seen this before, right?
No, I'm
an insolvency guy, yeah. He's living in the home. This guy's not getting away with it either. He's living in his relative's house. He's sitting at the same table, eating off of his table. He eats and drinks plenty, he's wearing good clothing, and I skip some of the description, as enjoyable as it is. He's sitting doing nothing, he doesn't want to get a job. He's not even engaged in what used to be his business. He knows anything he makes is just going to go to the creditor. So there I skipped some of the demands that he makes. But one of the demands he makes is, the creditor requests of the rabbinical court to make this borrower swear that he will in fact pay off the debt of any from anything that comes into his hands, and that he won't be able to sit doing nothing. Eliaso Kidarko Bali Ramaut. He must be involved in work normally without any games. Vigbenu Akol Bechovo, and he will pay it all for payment of the debt. And he says, "Vim amar eini motzi maos lehasek b'malachti." And if he says, "Well, I need capital in order to start up my business," shani aisi ragya lahalbos beribis, because I used to lend money and charge interest, right, in permissible ways. But that's what he says. V'amar lama v'ani amtil chamos. So the creditor says, "No problem. I'll front you the money." Now, this is what's called doubling down.
There's one born every day.
Right. Oh, or he says, or alternatively, I'll bring you into my business and you will manage my business. So, yeah, I would like you to compel this person in order to make him do this. The no same times, he says that's the law. He says that's what should happen. The no same time lidvarav. And the creditor explains his logic for this. V'amar, he says, look, kaman shepriyas balchov mitzvah. As we said in our class on bankruptcy 2 weeks ago, we said that paying off a creditor is indeed a mitzvah, right? We discussed sources for it and so on. V'arehu bari v'yachol his'aseh kolar v'yachkidarko v'lefrachavo. He's healthy. He's able to engage in his business. Nothing's stopping him, and then he can pay the debt. Emeinu rotza lasos mitzvah. Well, if he doesn't want to do a mitzvah, the rabbinical court is licensed, he says, to strike him to death. They're entitled to beat him in order to make him do this. Whether it's really that they're supposed to be beating him is a good question, but that's what the creditor is arguing. He says the court is licensed to compel people to work or to do their mitzvah. Further, he says, this guy should be first in line. If the court has a lineup of people who they should be forcing to do their mitzvah, this guy should be the head of the line. Because what he did was inappropriate. Va'od Omer Hamalben, the creditor also says, Shalafishnis Chayevli Bishtar Shekasuv Bo Shechayevli Atzmo Umamono Chiyuv Gomer. He says, this guy wrote it in the document. The loan document said that he is going to pay me. He obligated himself and his property. Then Nasanli Rishus Ligbos Mimeno Kafitana'o, and he gave me permission to claim according to the stipulations that are in the document. And you know what else is in this document? This document authorized me to collect under any terms, whether it's fitting Jewish law or not fitting Jewish law. So in that case, I can make whatever claims I want. Even if you'll tell me Jewish law doesn't say to do this, he said, I can do whatever I want. He stipulated whatever terms I want to use, I can use. This fellow was either really desperate to borrow the money, or he knew he was going to play this scam, and therefore he could get away with whatever he wanted. He continues, Umasha Amru Chazal, and when the sages said, right, in the English, it's the paragraph that starts, when the sages said, Kili b'nei Yisrael avadim, v'lo avadim la'avadim, when they said that, you're supposed to be a servant of God, not a servant of a human being, who is himself a servant of God. Hani mili bishvil shiyachal lomer lebala bayis harei mosecha biyadcha. That is because the worker is able to say to his employer, keep your money. Va'afilu shekibaldi la'asos imcha kol hayom, ein gufi meshuvalach ve'ni rotza la'asos imach yoser. That's because normally the employee is able to say, keep your money, I agreed to work for you for that period of time, but I don't want to. And you don't have a claim over me, I'm not bound to you. Because I took nothing from you. But that's his key. He says, the reason why you can't enslave somebody, a worker, is because the worker doesn't owe you anything. But this guy owes me. Avalzeh, this fellow, Shanatal Ma'osai, he took my money, v'halach, and he left. He wants to sit doing nothing, eating my money. Right, with this game, Yoser Nachon, he evet lova liishmalve. It would be better to invoke another Talmudic phrase, which is that the borrower is the slave to the lender. He owes me. So, therefore, he's not entitled to any protection. Further, he writes, this is the last part of his question, and this brings us to the marriage discussion. Gam kenami mi shechiyev gufo b'shtar. As well, somebody who obligated his body with a document. V'hisna mimenu b'kalach b'ezeh din shehirtzeh. And he bound himself under any legal system, Vare Dina Melech Shamasne al Asmo Lishtabed Yesh Lishtabed Bo. Sorry, this is a separate point. He says, under the rules of the local government, a person can encumber himself physically for payment of the debt. Where we live in Germany in the 13th century, in fact, the government does recognize debt slavery. And then he gets to the marriage point. The Hevi Raya, this creditor, brought a proof, Mitshuva LaGaon, from a responsum of one of these Gaonim, the heads of the yeshiva, Shahora Shechayev Adam Lahaskir Atzmo Kedei Lizones Ishto. This Gaon had ruled that there was a husband who couldn't support his wife, and the Gaon said he is obligated to hire himself out, Mishum Tnai Shehisna Biksuvasa, because of a condition written into the ketubah document. And he goes on to quote Rabbi Moshe of Kutzi, the author of the Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, who quoted Rabbeinu Eliyahu, who said that indeed one is obligated to hire himself out to support his wife, because in the ketubah document it says, Vana eflach va'okir ve'ezon, I am going to work for, I am going to honor, and I am going to feed my wife. So, black and white, you agreed to it in the ketubah, therefore you have to get a job to support her. And the same thing should be true over here. So that's the question that is put to the Rush. He says, this fellow is cheating me. There are any number of reasons why I should be able to get him to pay me. Now, the truth of the matter is that the real answer to this question was in the opening line. Right? What did he say in the opening line of the question? He encumbered all property he owns. Therefore, he can't give it away. Right? I'm not really sure why this even makes it past the first sentence. And the Rush says that. If you look at his answer, where it says response in the English, he says, Tshuva, here's your answer. Kevin sheshibed Reuven l'Shimon kol nechasav. Since Reuven encumbered all of his property to Shimon, the borrower to the creditor, metalti agav mekarkoi, movables along with land, din hu sheyigbe Shimon es chovo mi metalti shezmacha Reuven on his son of Laacher. So he's able to collect it. That's it. Just take the assets and you're done. Zeb.
Look, I understand how he can do that with the real property, but how can he do it with the movables?
With the movables. Because you encumbered it. You're entitled to make anything you want to security.
But I mean, the guy who holds it now, I mean,
is out of luck.
Is he out of luck? I mean, really?
Right, that's actually an interesting question. That's an interesting question. Normally we have a rule that movables are not encumbered. Precisely because you can't do a title search on movables. Land is one thing, movables are another story. But if you write an explicit stipulation here, it sounds like he's saying that actually does work. Yeah, you know what? Let me.
How can one person buy something from another person?
Right. He'll never know that it's actually free of encumbrance.
Well, you're going to have to go back, obviously, if that person you're going to sue them, right? I mean, if somebody sells you something, you don't want to, but this thing, it's not like you're just going to take it on the chin and walk away. You're still going to go back to that person and say,
you still
owe me what you sold me, or the value you gave me.
You are, but that's...
In Canadian law, if you buy stolen property, not knowing it will be stolen, and it's not food,
Zeb's point is beyond the question of recourse. The question is there even such a thing as an encumbrance on movables? Because we do have this concern. And the answer I'm going to give you is that I want to email it out later in the follow-up on the class because I want to look it up. It's a good question. I don't know.
Even on the real property, this problem.
Right, but the idea is that because land is such a public thing, therefore you will be able to do your title search before you buy it and make sure, or you will know there's a lien on it. Yeah.
You have a date on it.
Yeah, that's the idea. So his first point is the stuff's encumbered and therefore this is moot. Nonetheless, he deals with the slavery question. And he writes, Umasha Toin Shimon Shiasa Malacha Kadela Froas Chovo, as far as Shimon's claim that this fellow should have to work in order to pay off his debt, aid based in Kofen Osolakah. He says the rabbinical court can't compel him to do so. Why? Because he says when the Torah presents the laws of security, where this fellow had secured his debt with something, and then he defaults, and now you want to go claim it out of his estate, Even there, the rule is, as he quotes, the agent of the court is not entitled to go into his property to take the security. He's not entitled to invade the guy's property. He stands outside, and the debtor brings it out. So he says, if I'm not entitled even to do that, certainly then, kol shekein shlo yishlachu beis din yad begufo, they can't do something to his person in order to enslave him. And he quotes Rabbeinu Tam, a major authority of the 12th and 13th centuries, who wrote in a responsum indeed, and this goes back to the passage in the Talmud that we read before, when the Torah says he is sold off for his theft, b'gneva so, it includes also lo v'peron chovo, lo v'mizonos ishto. A person is not sold into slavery to pay his debts or even support for his wife. He says it's not. That's Rabbeinu Tam. So what he has said so far is that, as far as it relates to our questions, no, you cannot enslave him to pay off his debt. And even if he stipulated in the document, you can't force him to do so. However, he now has a problem, because the writer who sent him this question did in fact note that there's a responsum out there that required a man to get a job to support his wife. What are you going to do with that responsum? I mentioned, I mistranslated before when he said it was from a Gaon. I rendered it as Gaon, like the heads of the academies before, but it's not. It's Rabbeinu Eliyahu, who's post-Gaonic. He's just using the term Gaon to mean somebody of great authority. But there is this responsum from a great authority. His name is Rabbeinu Eliyahu, who said you have to get a job to support your wife. How does that square with saying that we don't enslave people? So take a look at the last paragraph of his response. Umashahaya Omer Rabbeinu Eliyahu. As far as what Rabbeinu Eliyahu said, Shechayav Adam Lahaskir Asma Ulafarnes Ishto, that one is obligated to hire himself out and support his wife. He says, Rabbeinu Tam Nachwa Kalav, you're right, or Rabbeinu Tam disagreed. Okay, so it's a debate, and Rabbeinu Tam brought all sorts of proofs, and I'm not going to go into it at length here, he says. And then he says, perhaps there is a distinction to draw. It's possible, he says, that Rabbeinu Eliyahu would agree, outside of the context of marriage, in the case of a normal debt, he would agree that you cannot force the guy to get a job in order to pay off the debt. It's only when it comes to support for one's wife, because, as he concludes, it's written into the ketubah. You took on this obligation of working in order to support her. And he says the language of the ketubah is not simply an agreement between two people. This is considered to be law, binding law, from which other laws are learned. In other words, this is a core text of Jewish law. When you look at the text of the ketubah, you don't mess with the ketubah document. He says, it is considered to be binding, even more than the agreement this fellow freely entered into. The ketubah has special status.
Doesn't it sound, though, like the behavior of this guy?
Yeah.
Sounds very close to theft. It's maybe it's not heavily theft, but it's more than just a loan that he can't pay back.
Right.
So it sounds to me like you could make an argument that it's closer to the case of husbands or bargains as far as the wife, or closer to the case of a theft, where you would be able to sell him if you have that slavery, because his behavior is so egregious that he's going to put himself into that kind of category.
Right. So I would say two things in response. The number one is, I don't know, although I think the creditor thinks he knows, but I don't know what the intent was at the time of the original loan. Was this fellow planning this all along or not? The other thing I would note is that rabbinical courts operate within two systems. There is the law, and then there is extrajudicial authority. And they have extrajudicial, I'm not even talking pshara and compromise, that doesn't sound like it's on the table for these two characters. But they do have the ability to transcend letter of the law when they feel it appropriate. They can levy fines and they can do all sorts of stuff to make people comply with moral behavior. So it could be that if he didn't have the ability to say, well, everything's encumbered, go take it out of the relative's house, he could have gone that route. Whether requiring him to get a job fits into that is a problem, because then he'd be violating religious law regarding enslavement. So maybe you'd have to find some other way. But I just want to make sure to get through the responsum here and its application to our initial questions. What Rabbeinu Asher, the Rosh, is saying here is, to answer our questions, number one, the Jew is not entitled to forfeit his right to at-will employment, with the possible caveat that Rama gives, that it's only if it's 3 years or longer, or more than 3 years, as the commentators to Rama, to Rabbi Yisrael, let's say. If it's less than 3 years, it seems like he can, indeed. Further, Rabbi Yisrael is saying it's where you're in his house, in his facility. That's where it's an issue. If you're working in your own house, you're a craftsman, right? And you make things in your own shop, maybe it's not a concern. But the key element is forfeiting your freedom and saying, I'm not going to be allowed to break this agreement. That's something that you wouldn't actually be entitled to do. And even when you stipulate it in a document, it will have no force. That's the like the case that we see here. You're not entitled to forfeit that. In terms of the marriage case, though, that appears to be unique. The ketubah has unique authority, and the commentators on this discussion, where it appears in Choshen Mishpat Tzadi Zayin, the references at the top of the last page, source number 15, commentators discuss why the ketubah is exactly different. What happens in more contemporary law after the time of Rabbeinu Asher? Take a look at source 15 and 16, please. Source number 15, Rabbi Yosef Karo, initial author of the Shulchan Aruch, of the Code of Jewish Law, in the 1550s, 1560s, writes the following. Ein kofen oso lahaskir atzmo v'lalaso shum malacha kedei lefroa. One may not compel a debtor to hire himself out to do any work in order to pay. Va'afilu hisnal atzmo sheyispos hamalvez gufo. And even where he accepted this on himself, that his body should be claimed, so to speak, the cause of lo zeh b'shtar, he wrote it in the document, eino mo'il, it is not effective. Ve'eino yachol lo lo usrov lo lishta beidbo, he can't imprison him, he cannot enslave him. This is recorded as law. And in terms of marriage, source number 16, Rabbi Yisrael says, indeed, some say, and we know who he's quoting, that one would be obligated to hire himself out as a worker in order to be able to feed his wife. The question comes up from time to time in Jewish law in response to regarding taking a 3-year contract. Rabbi Moshe Sofer, in his Chasam Sofer, Choshen Mishpat Kuf Ayin Beis, permits a 3-year or longer contract, but only as long as one is an at-will employee. Only as long as one is able to walk away, should he so choose. And that is our topic. How does that work?
Yeah.
The same way it works in secular society.
So you make a contract, but you, as long as you have a notice period, you can break it?
Yeah. That seems to be, that's the way it works in society as a whole, and that's the way it works here. Yes, Yehuda. For anyone who has to go, feel free. I don't want to force people.
Thank you very much for this wonderful series, as usual, as we did.